Blog Talk Radio.
Friends, lovers, and sisters in the struggle for human dignity and freedom, I am here to represent the struggle that has gone on for 300 or more years, a struggle to be recognized as citizens in a country in which we were born. I have had about 40 or 50 years of struggle, ever since a little boy on the streets of Norfolk called me a nigger. I struck him back. I had to learn that hitting back with my fist one individual was not enough. It takes organization. It takes dedication. It takes a willingness to stand by and do what has to be done when it has to be done. A nice gathering like today is not enough. You have to go back and reach out to your neighbors who don't speak to you. And you have to reach out to your friends who think they are making it good and get them to understand that they, as well as you and I, cannot be free in America or anywhere else where there is capitalism and imperialism until we can get people to recognize that they themselves have to make the struggle and have to make the fight for freedom every day in the year, every year, until they win it. Thank you.
Look at two of the most important civil rights organizations have in common. Meet Ella Baker, the brilliant black woman whose ideas and careful grassroots organizing helped give birth to Dr. King's Southern Christian Leadership Conference and to the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee. For this reason, Ella Baker is reverentially known as the mother of the civil rights movement. Born in Virginia in 1903, Ella Baker was educated at Shaw University before moving to New York City in 1927. By 1930, she started organizing.
Ella Baker joined the NAACP in 1940 and helped young leaders find their voice and their leadership capacity. One of those people was Rosa Parks, someone we all know. Ella Baker was also recruited by Martin Luther King to help run the Southern Christian Leadership Conference, which was helping to build the civil rights movement.
Then in 1960, a group of black college students were denied service at Woolworth's segregated lunch counter in Greensboro, North Carolina. In an act of nonviolent protest, the students refused to leave, inspiring similar sit-ins across the South.
Ella Baker left SCLC to help a group of young people form the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee.
I remember Ms. Baker saying, many of you are from some of the quote-unquote best schools in the country. So when you go into rural areas, don't go in there thinking you're going to lead the people. Find out what the people want.
When you stood in the Baker seat, you were ready to get out there. She really wanted us to stand up and speak up and speak out. And she gave you the energy to push. You can lead. You can be somebody. You can do something.
More interested in affecting change than public acclaim for financial reward, Baker inspired a generation of young Americans to risk their lives to fight racism, sexism, and white supremacy. Simply put, the mother of the civil rights movement had many children, and we are her heirs.
And greetings. Welcome to another segment of New Day, Resurrection and Liberation. My name is Empress Chi, and as usual, it is always a pleasure and an honor to be with you. Tonight, of course, we are continuing our week-long conference. We call it Here We Stand and Rise Above It All. This conference is a part of our commemoration for the International Human Rights Day, which, of course, took place on December 10th. And also, we are observing or preparing to observe the petition that Paul Robeson took to the United Nations in 1951. So all this week, we've been doing different forums, conversations, and so forth that highlight Black human rights, the violations, how we need to proceed, and so forth. And so we've been focusing on a few of the people who have made contributions to our struggle, both in civil rights and, of course, in human rights. And so with that said, we would be remiss if we did not begin to make it very clear that we have examined the work of several. And while there might not have been in all instances the conversation of human rights per se, their actions, work, tenacity, and other things certainly lend to that. We are not hearing, at least I don't hear often, the conversation about some of the women who were pivotal, who were key in particularly the civil rights era. We are very familiar, of course, with Mother Rosa Parks, and it's interesting that many call Mother Rosa Parks, and we also now call her Saint Rosa Parks, but many often refer to her as the mother of the civil rights movement. Also, another sister who is also a saint, Mamie Till, they also have called her the mother of the civil rights movement. And as you just heard, there is also some who call Saint Ella Baker the mother of the civil rights movement. So whichever you prefer, all of these women did in fact play a major role in the development of the movement for justice, for civil and human rights of our people. Today, December the 13th, marks not only the Earth Day of the great Saint Ella Baker, but also her actual transition day. She was literally born on 1903 on this date and made transition in 1986 on this day. So certainly, that just always just blows my mind when I think about it, that she literally, you know, on both of those days, I mean, the same day. So to me, there's something very powerful and very, you know, just poignant about something like that. At any rate, the National Million Women Marching Universal Movements now have what we call 25 sister saints. And so we have begun the first phase of the installment process, and that is what we call it, the installment or installation process of declaring 25 Black women as, and why not? Other people have saints, Saint Patrick, Saint Benedict, Saint, you know, they got saints all over the place. Where's ours? So we're taking the initiative to declare some of our people saints. And right now we're starting with 25 sisters. And we're sure as time goes on and develop that will continue in other arenas. But got to start somewhere, and we're making the start with us as Black women. Again, we have 25 sister saints, and Saint Ella Baker is one of them, along with, of course, Saint Fannie Lou Hamer, Saint Queen Mother Moore, Saint Amy Jacks Garvey, Saint Hesitput. Oh, yeah. Saint Nanny the Maroon. Saint Yaasantawa. I mean, again, 25 sister saints. And each one of those sisters, there will be a specific initiative as it pertains to their work that they were doing, that they did, their contributions. We are obligated to do things based on the history and the legacy of our people. We can't just talk about what they did. We've got to come up with what we're going to do to honor them and to continue their work. So with that said, we begin to give some basic fundamental kinds of information. And you just heard, of course, something in regards to Ella Baker. You heard a little history about her. But you also we also started out with you actually hearing her voice, hearing her speech, hearing what she wanted to share with the masses of the people. So now we're going to give you just a little bit more before we start going more into some what some of the next steps are in terms of MWM and highlighting some of the work that she did. And by the way, I don't use the word mentor often, but she was definitely a guide to several people that we all know. Now, you heard, of course, Dr. Martin Luther King. And I know also a black man by the name of Stokely Carmichael, also known as Kwame Ture. There are several that she literally gave guidance to and helped with their growth and development. And again, we're going to do a special salute as a part of the Million Woman World March in 2024, and yes, we will be doing it in 2024. We decided not to do it this year because it was conveyed to us spiritually to do it next year. And so as we have indicated to some, next year there is a presidential election. Next year is also the final year for the International Decade for African People, and so we decided to do it in those years so that we can literally connect the black dots in such a way that we can organize, mobilize, agitate, politicize, and move some things forward. And so October, Million Woman World March, Washington, D.C. We'll tell you the date at another time because we don't want to put that out just yet, but we will very soon. But you can begin to get ready. And at that point, we will begin to introduce the Black Agenda 25 and other related initiatives that we have. So, again, let's go back for a moment to hear more about Saint Ella Baker. And with that said, family, again, we hope that this will be inspiring to you. We know it's going to be informative, but we want it to also be inspiring and motivational. So let's do this.
First of all, most of the literature I've read, they've spoken rather highly of you. Don has gone so far to dedicate works to you. Howard Zinn, his Black Abolitionist, Leon Hope, his work on Mississippi Freedom Summer. These men, Dr. Chu, were one of the main cause of the squeal that these subsequent movements fought on. So I wanted to talk to you this morning, and I'd like for you to share with me some of your experiences and accounts of the role you played in SPLC and your interpretations of roles of individuals played in the organization that you might be necessary to give me more insight as to the dynamics involved and the programs that SPLC ultimately initiated. So my first question to you, as I was saying earlier, is can you mention to me or point out to me other facts that were fired from the Montgomery movement and, say, the 1954 Supreme Court decision, which may have contributed to of the founding of SPLC when it was founded in 57?
Well, I think what you have is a question of continuity of struggle. You said that people have referred to me largely in terms of maybe being a factor. And that, I think, sprang from the fact that in the school phase several years before that, a number of years before that, in the 40s, in the late 30s, and in the 40s, but the 40s in particular, I was working with the National Association for the Advancement of Colored People, and a primary function of mine was to go into areas, maybe some of the areas that had not been visited in a long while. For instance, I used to leave New York sometime in February, and go into Florida and start at the Beach of St. Pete's Tampa. And that was because we did not have, the association didn't have an active branch in Miami at the time. So we would work around St. Pete's Tampa and up the east or the west coast, the Palm Beach, and on and up, Pompanoes, all places, and get Jacksonville, from Jacksonville to Tallahassee, Tallahassee to Pensacola, Pensacola into Georgia, into Mobile, to Alabama, Alabama to Georgia, Georgia up until you came into Virginia. So that had been my itinerary for several years, and in the process, it was not to be unthought of that I had touched a number of people who had not been visited for a long time by association personnel. So that may account for the whatever historical impact I may have had. In addition to that, in 54, the 54 decision was frequently interpreted by people as being the end of the struggle, because the NAACP's struggle had been one of legal action to a large extent. And the 1954 decision culminated a effort on the part of the lawyers of the association to raise the question of the constitutionality of racial segregation. And this was the case on which that got verbalization. And so that becomes a historical monument. And to some people, it almost is interpreted as being the end of the struggle. But as we have seen from the history of the question of racial segregation and discrimination, we have had court action that has been nullified from time immemorial. Let's go back to the Reconstruction period, and I'm not going into that, but you go back there. Much of what was supposedly gained in the 40s and 50s legally had been supposedly secured to us in the right after the Reconstruction period. And you know those laws are not applied. So, SCLC, why? It was...
You were about to speak to the why of SCLC.
Well, I think the basic why of SCLC has to do with what had taken place in the 54 decision, and the unthought of Montgomery bus boycott. But before you can evaluate the bus boycott, you have to understand how it came about. And it didn't come out of a vacuum. There were two people in Montgomery who had functioned with the NAACP over the years, and they were Mrs. Rosa Parks and Ed E.D. Nixon. Not Ed, I don't know what his name was, but E.D. Nixon. Where did E.D. Nixon get his fire? He got his fire as a sense of social action from being a member of the Brotherhood of Sleeping Car Corners and the struggle that it had waged over the years. So when the Montgomery bus boycott, let's call it, ended successfully, here you had a social phenomenon that had not taken place in the history of those of us who were around at that time, where hundreds of people and even thousands of people, just ordinary people, had taken a position that put them in a very uncomfortable, at least for me when they decided to walk rather than to ride the bus. And this was a mass action, and a mass action that anybody who looked at the social scene would have to appreciate and wonder, those of us who believe that mass, only through mass action are we going to eliminate certain things, would have to think in terms of how does this get carried on? And so whatever the reasons or however the historical accidents, history or whatever else, that precipitated Martin as the president. And that's quite the story. I'm not going into it, I'm here for that. But whatever those factors were, he was there as the spokesman for the boycott. And out of the boycott, he became a worldwide known individual, articulating the strivings and the hopes and so forth of the people who were involved in the boycott.
At this time, you were working with the NAACP.
No, at 54?
No, at 57.
No. See, I left the NAACP nationally in 46. And then I served, I worked at the local branch, and I think I was the president in the 50s, somewhere in the 50s. In 1957, at the time that the SDLC was formally organized, I think that's when it was formally organized, I was doing a program that of trying to educate or trying to stimulate action on the part of Black and Puerto Rican parents in respect to the school situation. See, the New York City had taken, had set up a commission for the Commission on De Facto Segregation, I believe, I'm not sure, but they were supposed to be eliminating de facto segregation in the school system in New York. And so for the summer of 57, we had weekly meetings with parents in the different quarters, for getting them to deal with the question of their school, what's happening to their children. And that's where Kenneth Clark came into the picture on the whole area of
You mentioned the fact that E.D. Nixon probably got a lot of his fire from his early affiliation with Sleepy Talk Holdings. And Ms. Rosa Parks had been an NAACP member for a long time. But also in the account is to where Ms. Parks had attended earlier the Harlem Folk School. This was a place in Montego, Tennessee, as you know, where people would go, aspiring to be leaders in the community, to get different kinds of training as to how to make best go about doing it. And it was right after that Ms. Parks decided that she wasn't going to give up her seat. So it's a question over here as to where her primary motivation came from as to the reason she didn't give up her seat. Have you heard that story before about the
Florence? Sure. Well, the first time Mrs. Parks left Montgomery to go anywhere, she said, was to come to Atlanta to a regional leadership training conference that I happen to have organized. When I was precipitated into the directorship of branches in the NAACP, one of the first things I projected was the idea of the need for training of the people who were carrying on branch activity. And when I said training, largely in terms of preparing giving them the information and broadening the scope of their understanding of what was involved. One of the reasons was that I had seen that many, to a large extent, most of these branches were feeling that their duty was to provide some membership and some money to the National Army. They had attitudes that were not particularly helpful in terms of change. For instance, Atlanta or somewhere else. I'm not identifying Atlanta per se as such, but they would be against the idea of going to battle for the town group who happened to have been maybe brutalized and being arrested. Because who was he? And in some places like Buffalo, New York, for instance, most of the black children were coming out with high school with just certificates attesting to the fact that they had been in attendance. I frequently would have people ask me as I came up from the deep south, upstate Virginia, North Carolina, how are things down south? Which meant that to them, that's where the problem was, and they had not identified the problem in their own area.
Involved a large number of people, and
So the question arises, where do you go from here? Also, the question arose in respect to mass action. Does the NAACP lend itself to mass action, or will it initiate mass action, or will it continue its program of legalism? And so some... So the question in some of our minds is that there was something there that should continue, that you needed a force in the South that was comparable to the NAACP in some respects. Why? Because the NAACP, in the minds of those of us who were concerned at that stage, primarily dealt with legal action. And although it had a program of branch action, it had not organized mass action that lent itself to demonstrations, etc. So if you think in terms of something in the South for mass action, and you start with the group that had been involved in something. So there was Montgomery. And in connection with Montgomery, there were large numbers of black ministers, or a number of black ministers throughout the area, who had identified with that struggle. For instance, C.K. Steele in Tallahassee, Florida, and Abraham of something or other in New Orleans. And Jameson had a boycott of his own in Baton Rouge, you see. So what you do then is stimulate the thought of an organization in the South that can spread.
At this point, you may be able to help me clear up another question, too. There's a question as to where the initial call for this conference came from. Reading a book like Lewis Miller, they suggest that the call came from C.K. Steele. Well, I went down and interviewed Reverend Steele, and he assured me that the call did come from him. He responded to the call. He's some Jewish talking or some funny talking man called him. He's always thought it was Jeff Preston, and asked him if he would go along with the conference in late 56. Late December 56. And he said, yeah, it was just this kind of a thing. He had just finished this Tallahassee thing, and they were at the city council. So I'm trying to pin down if it's any way possible.
I don't know whether you can pin it down other, because I think Wyatt may not to verify the fact that there were three of us who talked into the wee hours of the morning in terms of how do you develop a force that can enlarge upon the gains or the impact of the Montgomery force boycott.
Did the three represent you, Fire,
Stanley Levinson. Largely at Stanley's house. He's the man with some money. And Bryce and I would go over there. Not living very used to. Brian and me. Because I knew the South. Comparatively. In terms of their knowledge of it. They had not had as wide knowledge as I had. Plus the fact I had been associated with the NAACP. And so we talked for 3 hours, and the concept of trying to develop out of the Montgomery Bus Boycott leadership a force. And when they approached, no doubt, Martin and whoever else, it was largely their response would be in terms of ministry. That's why you get the ministerial thing. You couldn't think in terms of a leadership out around a bus boycott without also thinking of C.K. Steele's efforts and Jameson.
McCullough, South Carolina.
McCullough has, he came a little bit after that. But you see, then when you go into the whole question of, as which was the pattern in the South, who are the leaders and winners, which may or may not be justifiable, but that's how it starts. And so then, let's say the fall came for Martin.
Yeah, well, that's with basically the fall.
Yeah, but I'd say so. Historically, he gets credit for it, but let it be known that no one individual really conceives of an idea like that without somewhere, somehow, some other thing.
Right. Now, I can see a great deal participating or having leading to the founding of SCLC. The next question in my mind is, after this was realized that there was a need for somewhat of an instrument to try and spread this movement that was in Montgomery with the hope of bringing about greater social change, what was the notion of the kind of an organization you would have? I know you said have a great deal of ministers, but would it be one with just the president and a lot of lieutenants, a president and executive secretary with a great deal of power? Was it a democratic organization in conception, a strong dictatorial organization? What was the thinking about the nature of the organization at this time?
Well, the thinking about the nature of the organization was there with the people who were doing the thinking. Those of us who preferred an organization that was democratic and where the decision-making was left with the people, would think in one vein, and the organizing of active, let's call it chapters or units of people. But when you reckon with the fact that the majority of the people who were called together were ministers, and the decision as to who was called together emanated, no doubt, from both the background out of which, let's call it, Martin came, and maybe lack of understanding, I'm willing to grant, of the virtue of utilizing the mass surge that had developed, say, in Montgomery. Just look at Montgomery. What has happened since in Montgomery? What?
Right. But there's another problem here.
So I think that came, the nature of the organization became to a large extent a ministerial thing. Out of the 100 plus, I forgot how many, that were present at that initial meeting where the formal organizing organization took place, I think Whitney Young and guys from Mississippi, whom I had worked with for a number of years. I can't think of his name. No. Anthony Moore in Cleveland, Mississippi, were among the maybe two or three non-ministers present. And I was the only woman, and I think maybe another person came.
That
is. Do you think the reason for that was most of the ministers at that time? Basically, yes.
They
had the power to. Well, not only, you see, not only the power,
together.
No, not only the power, but when you haven't been accustomed to mass action, and they are, you see, basically your ministers are not people who go in for decisions on the part of people. I don't know whether you realize it or not. And you see, they have been looked upon as saviors. And so what happens is, here they are faced with a suggestion that goes against the grain and for which they are not, with which they are not prepared to deal. So they come together.
There's one other question. Namely, the question involving Dr. King, first year president of SCLC, at the same time, he was still president of MIA. And I'm wondering if that ever caused
Interesting interview that took place in 1976, I believe it was. And what you heard there was directly from Saint Ella Baker in terms of what many do not know about the March on Washington. At another time, we're going to do part two, and we will go more into some other aspects of the civil rights movement. And again, it behooves us to know and have a better understanding, overstanding of some of these things, because we are supposed to be continuing some of the legacy, some of the work of those who come before us. Well, if we don't know what that is to the degree of reality, then obviously we cannot move forward, which we obviously are not. And I dare say a part of that is because we really don't know some of the real basic but yet powerful things. So to capsulize what you just heard, and again, we're going to play a little more, but if you all have a question or a comment or something that you might want to bring into the conversation for right now, we certainly lend that to you to do so. You could just press one. But the point is this. Clearly, what some might think happened based on St. Ella Baker didn't when it came to the organizing, the conception, and so forth of the March on Washington. Now, remember, that was the first time anything like that had happened to that magnitude. And note what she said very clearly, and see, we have to make sure that certain things are now understood to a better extent. But what she said very clearly was the ministers had no experience in mass organizing, which, of course, St. Ella Baker had, because she had done that on her campus. When they ran into a problem on campus, she organized alumni for Shaw University to come to that campus, which they did. So she did have experience. That's just one of several. Plus, of course, she was in the NAACP, but that all of that became problematic cause for a black woman to be, shall we say, not a kiss-up or a kiss-butt kind of type, you were in serious trouble, which is why a lot of our sisters during that time period would just kind of do the work and not say a lot. Because if they said too much, it would not be accepted or taken very kindly, et cetera, et cetera. And so many of them regulated themselves or, you know, said, well, listen, we're just going to do the work. We're not going to talk. We're not going to give our opinion beyond a certain point. Well, St. Ella Baker wasn't one of them people, as you will hear in some other excerpts that we play in part two of talking about her at another time. But we wanted to share with you the importance of this woman, because you do not hear much about her, although she literally was a catalyst and an inspiration to several that we do give recognition to today, men, brothers. But you do not hear about women like Ella Baker, Fannie Lou Hamer, and others. And so what we're saying, family, is that if we are genuinely going to move forward in a certain kind of way, we got to speak truth to power all across the board. And having what and what once I experience what I have with Million Women March, I have a very good idea as to some of what happened in the past, because I saw what happened in that present time. In terms of the embracing of women who were powerful, wanting to do certain things, and yet all this other crazy stuff was thrown in the mix, and some of it was really unnecessary to the degree that it was. But again, these were learning things that really helped myself and others to really know what was really going on, as Marvin Gaye said. What's going on? Well, we found out. Going up in some of the circles that we were able to go up in and really seeing firsthand what it really meant, or what some really meant when they said, oh, they love black women, or they admire the work of black women and all this old stuff. Let me tell you, some of that stuff is as bogus as a $3 bill, because it's a good conversation, but when you're right in the midst of it, there's a whole nother kind of interaction. And those of you listening, excuse me, probably have experienced what I'm talking about and or have seen it. Experienced it directly or have seen it yourself. So the point is, we really got to do better. We really got to, again, deal with some realities and realize that by hindering our women and girls, we're really hindering our overall capability to advance our movement and struggle. Because as many have said and many have agreed, a nation will rise no higher than its women. And so we're saying all this now to say, yo, this has got to stop, because this has been going on for a while. When I talk to sisters who were in the 50 era, 60 era, and thereabouts, I mean, it's just unbelievable, some of the stuff that we have learned that has happened. And we get it. I mean, all of us have been affected by the system of off-white supremacy. So, yeah, we know it. But today, in the 21st century, and that's not to say that we're still not affected severely, but at the same time, we do know a lot more than what folks did know. We have a lot more access to information. We have a lot more capability in certain manners, in certain ways. And so we now have got to move forward accordingly. So with that said, let me be the first to tell everybody that our position now with MWM, Universal Movements, is we're not having it. We're not having it. Believe me, we will definitely make sure that it's understood that you're either going our way or you're in the way. And when I say going our way, I'm not talking about just MWM. I'm talking about in the spirit of Black/African justice and liberation. So who's ever representing that, that's who we are a part of too, vice versa. And this now has to be made very, very clear, because a lot of other stuff is just like fluff, and some of it is not even real. Some of what we're seeing is not real. It's hoopla. It's money-making. It's hustle. And I don't mean hustle in terms of, yeah, I'm working. No, I mean hustle as in, I'm going to do this to get some money. And that's not the spirit that our people come out of when it comes to fighting for our people. So when you hear or heard Sank to Ella Baker, you heard a genuine Black woman who loved her people, our people, and fought severely, with unapologetically, not just the so-called enemy that we all know, not so-called, but the enemy that we, you know, have known, which has been what I call our unnatural enemy, but the people, some of the people surrounding her, us. And that's what she alluded to in part of what you just heard when she talked about, and others have said it too, there's a lot of folks that did not like Dr. Martin Luther King. And I'm talking about ministers and other so-called leaders, you see. And so, you know, we're not going to belabor that point, but we must make sure we begin to tell the truth about certain things, because it's creating illusions. Lastly, and again, if you have a question or comment, please feel free to press 1. When we were doing the research for this segment tonight, we, of course, ran across the Ella Baker Center for Human Rights. And our position is, if we know that a group T is doing certain kinds of work, we are going to reach out. If it's something that we are working on and we think it's something that we can collaborate with someone on, they're already doing it, we're not trying to override or outdo or any of that unnecessarily. So we reach out to people to let them know, hey, this is what we're doing. This is what we're working on. We would love to talk to you about it. Let's see what we can do together, jointly, whatever. Well, in most cases, I can tell you how that has turned out. And I can document that, by the way. But this was a similar case. But here's what we learned, which we didn't know, which is why it behooves us to do research. So I did not realize how that center was founded, or, you know, what was the people or whatever behind it. you know, I just kind of assumed certain things. But then when I look further, I realize that, wait a minute, let me check this out. Now, I unfortunately never met Mother Ella Baker, Saint Ella Baker, who did very, very soon to get more insight. But from what I saw so far and heard so far, while she was, you know, very diverse and about all people and all of that, she was very clear about Black folks, you see. And so what that means is, you know, she worked with all folk, but her issue, position, work, and all of that had a very specific mission, and that was about Black folks. When I looked at the center named for her, I saw a lot of different things. And I'm saying that to say that because for whatever reason, our people have not developed particular independent institutions to the degree that we really needed to. Other people have formulated these various groups utilizing various folks' names or concepts or whatever, but it's kind of interesting. I'll just put it to you like that for now. All right. And so, again, we're going to do part two at another time because I really want to talk with some of the people who actually knew her, meaning St. Ella, who worked with her, who was a youth when you know, because that's what she did. She worked a lot with youth. When you hear SNCC, I mean, she was the powerhouse for SNCC. You heard also she spoke of Mother Rosa Parks, who is also one of our saints. But as you could tell, the work that she was doing, preceded or was a prelude to what Mother Rosa Parks was doing, as with Dr. Martin Luther King. But yet, we are not studying the strategy and so forth of someone such as Ella Josephine Baker. Right? And so, again, family, I'm just saying we've got to change this stuff up a little bit. Before we go back to the last segment of this particular interview, again, I want to ask if there's any comments, thoughts about what we've talked about thus far. And again, we will be doing part two a little later. But I wanted to get that in for today because, again, today, December the 13th, does, in fact, mark both types of life changes, if you may. One, it's her Earth Day. She was born on this day, 1903, and she made transition on this day, 1986. All right. And so, again, I certainly wish that I had known about her, before she made transition. I really didn't. I really didn't. I might have heard her name, at some point, but not much. So, again, we've got to do better. All right, let's go to our live line, and we're going to talk with caller at 1-840. 1-840, your mic is open. And welcome to the segment of a special edition of New Day.
Okay, greetings, Sister Filet. Thank
you
so much.
Hey, Sister Sheila. How are you?
How you doing? All right. I'm enjoying this conversation because I agree with you. I've heard her name, but I wasn't real clear on the specifics of, you know, I knew she was in the civil rights. I knew about her SNCC involvement. But I love the fact that you're researching and presenting this because it's important. You know, her work was important. And who is it that's interviewing her? Because I came in late into the recording. Who is she speaking with?
it's a reporter, and again, I am not, you know, going through this research, this is the first time in preparing for tonight's program. There's things that I've just never, ever heard before. And it doesn't really indicate who the reporter is. I'm going to have to really go further to dig it up. As you can tell, it's not a very good quality from an audio perspective. Again, I just found it. But I think what you can kind of get is, you know, it's powerful, you know, to hear her in her own words, you know, to share certain things. And she, you know, in some other parts you will hear her literally, you know, say some very specific things that we heard about, but she says it. And what I'm talking about is, you know, as you study, you hear about what some of the issues were, and particularly how the women were treated or mistreated.
Because you know, I just listened to something the other night on WURD regarding Pauli Murray and her involvement in the, what is it, the whole board versus the, while she was a law student at Howard University.
Right.
She was the only woman. And they just ignored her. But she did the template for the Desegregation Act board, you know, 1954 board versus, but they never mentioned her until recently, you know. And it's like I'm listening about Ella Baker, you know, and same kind of thing. All of the women were actually told to pretty much shut up on the day of the Washington March. From everything that I've heard, you know, they all had this background, just like you said, you know, this back movement that we just don't know about because they weren't up front. You know what I'm saying? They were behind the guys, you know.
Yep.
So I really appreciate your bringing this, and I'm glad that you mentioned. I was wondering if you could do anything about the sound quality because I was really struggling. It's like muffled. You know, you're clear.
Okay.
But the sound quality of the recording is a little muffled.
And again, I just found it, and so we didn't have time to really, you know, try to clean it up further. But literally, it'll have to go through, you know, equipment that can clean it up. That's going to happen, and I have to get someone to do that. But now that we at least got it, you know, we can now, you know. Brother Hanif is very good. I'm sure you remember Brother Hanif. He's very good at, you know, cleaning up, you know, old footage and things like that. But I literally just found this, a lot of this information in researching. There's just certain things that I had no idea about. And I'm going to give you another name, Sister Sheila, by the way. And also, family, you can write this down because we'll be talking about her, not right now, but at another point in time. Her name is Daisy Bates.
Yeah, heard of her name, same thing.
Yep.
Same thing.
That's another one. They hated her. And she, and with Daisy, Mother Ella Baker, she's kind of being more diplomatic in what she says. But Daisy Bates, well, that's a different ball game. And she died in 1999. But once again, I didn't know anything about her, even in 1999. I didn't know anything about Daisy. I mean, I maybe, again, heard the name. But these women were no joke. And for those that do not know about Daisy Bates, she was not only a publisher and a journalist. When it came for the I'm not going to tell you right now, but there's a major thing in history that she was one of the primary entities of when it came to so-called desegregation. And again, you know, this was the 50s, so, you know, that was the thing for that time period. But she was no joke, let me tell you. And see, these women will fight. And I mean, not just verbally, but, you know, they had a little something else going on, too, if you got in that kind of situation with them. But again, take a note of her name, Daisy Bates.
I've heard her name, but it's the same thing. So I thank you so much for this education, because
it's a pleasure and an honor. And by the way, I'll give folks a little hint. Little Rock, Arkansas.
The integration of the school?
Yep.
With the little girl, yeah. Okay, that was what Daisy Bates.
Who was the person that put that together? Who was the person that literally coordinated that, worked with the, you know, had the children to do AVNRC? Who was that person?
I don't know.
Yep. Well,
I'm guessing, based on what you're saying, I really don't know. But my guess is Daisy Bates, only because of the conversation. Right, but I didn't know that. I didn't know that. First of all, you know, like you hear the history, but you don't necessarily delve into, well, who you know what I'm saying? Who started it? You don't delve into that.
Absolutely.
So I just thank you so much. Thank you for bringing this. And I'm
still
listening.
It's a pleasure. Okay, well, I'm going to go back and play just a bit more, and then we're going to close out because we said we would only keep this about an hour. Again, these are just brief sessions to focus on primarily human rights, but, of course, you know, Brother Malcolm said we go from civil rights to human rights. So before we start really going deeply into the human rights piece, we're going to know a little more about the civil rights stuff, because we know the surface stuff, a lot of it.
Right.
But we really need to, it's like anything, we got to be more serious now with what we're doing, and particularly our women. You know, we got to get our sisters to another level, because the women are the ones who are, for the most part, they have the children in their care, you know, for those first 5 years in particular. So if the sisters know a lot more, that means the children are going to know a lot more, too, you see. And that's our best, you know, that's not rocket science. That is pretty, you know, mathematically clear.
Right.
So, my sister, I thank you again. And you'll be getting some information very soon, because we're gearing up for the United Nations for next year. We got a lot of good stuff coming for next year. This time we'll be directly involved, because we will be doing hands around the United Nations. So we'll be linking with sisters coming in from all over the diaspora that we've been building with. They'll be coming to the United States in March for the, you know, the CSW. And so now, absolutely. So I've been invited, you know, to do a couple of presentations.
I'm with you. And I'll be waiting for you.
Listen, one other thing, Sister Sheila, that you could definitely help us with, we're looking to take some students up to New York on May 19th. May 19th is the annual pilgrimage to Malcolm X's gravesite. So we want to take some of the children, some of the, you know, some of the students, the older students, with us for 2024.
Boys and girls.
Absolutely. Boys and girls. Well, we're going to need chaperones. We're going to need some of the sisters and brothers, you know, to help us with that. And so, you know, what we realize is, well, we don't know yet, because I'm talking to a few schools to see, you know, the feasibility of getting, you know, one of their buses or what have you, right?
So
the next couple of weeks we should be able to, you know, to have more insight into that. But I'm just putting it out there now. May 19th. That will
May
be
19th.
Malcolm X's birthday, May 19th. It's on a Sunday this year coming. And, course, every since his death, every since his death, his sister requested that there be a pilgrimage every year on the day of his birthday, and there has been. It's only one time that it didn't happen, and that was during COVID.
That was
the only time. But every year, people were going.
I've
All right,
never gone.
Thank you.
But All right, take care. Peace and blessings.
Thank you. All right, family, let me check to see if there's anyone else that has a question or a comment. And if not, we're going to finish up with just a couple of minutes more of this interview. And I'm going to, as Sister Sheila suggested, I'm going to research it further to kind of, you know, see who's doing the interview. I do know the year. I think that was 1976. Okay, and we will work on cleaning it up so that we can get the audio a lot clearer for you. So bear with us on that. But I just found this article or this particular interview, and that's one of the things that we're really now doing. And that is a lot of research. I'm coming up with some things that's like, wow. And so, you know, it's really just exciting to be able to dig in and find some of the things that we're now finding. And we're going to introduce you to a few new, well, they're not really new, but I've learned of a historian that I didn't know anything about until recently, Dr. Clyde Winters. And so when you hear about his work, oh, my gosh, but I digress. Let's go back and hear a little more of this interview, then we'll close out for tonight. Remember, later on this week, we will be doing, every day this week, of course, we'll be doing something. But remember, on December 17th, that's Paul Robeson Day. Paul Robeson Day, December 17th. So we'll be doing something special on that day. And then on December 18th, which will be the last day of this series, that will be Stephen Biko Day. So we will be then connecting the issue of human rights violations on a more diasporic level. Right now we're focusing on the U.S., but on Monday we will close out with paying a tribute to Stephen Bantu Biko. That is one of the days of recognition for him. So we'll tell you more about that on Saturday. And by the way, our regular program, of course, for New Day is Saturday at 10:30. We should be talking with a brother who is who has his own independent school in New York, Q Butter. And with that, they have a science fair for grades, oh, I think it's 4 to 12 or 6 to 12. I got to check the grade level. But they are doing incredible work. And did you notice the word I use, y'all? Independent, not charter, independent. And I got to ask this. Wait a minute. Sister Sheila, I'm going to open your mic up again. I forgot to ask you this question. Did you hear about there is an investigation here in Philadelphia saying that the black charter schools here in Philly, the various entities, meaning the schools and some of the teachers and so forth, are saying that the public school system, or Philadelphia public school, whatever it is, are discriminating against the black charter schools. Did you hear about that?
I have heard about it, and I know Dr. Palmer, Walt Palmer. And I remember what happened after he built that new building, that beautiful new building, and they took it over. Said his whatever was below par or whatever, which obviously, you know, knowing him, it wasn't. It was working.
Right.
You know, and now Veronica Joyner's going out too. You know, she's retiring, but it's the same kind of thing. Yeah.
Right.
And Imhotep stands very strong.
And Imhotep and Sankofa.
Sankofa. Is that West Philly?
No.
Not West.
Don't know about Sankofa? Ooh,
I've heard
okay.
of it, but I don't know where it is. Mm-mm.
Right.
Mm-mm.
That is Germantown. Just from the Germantown area.
Is that on Shelton Avenue? Where is it?
I'm not sure, I just remember it's in the Germantown Avenue. And I think also Harambe is doing well.
Good.
Yes. Now, that's in West Philly.
And they're the first, and they're still here. And I'm loving it.
Right.
You know, but I'm sure.
But the question for me is, is it still as it was envisioned? So that's a whole nother conversation. Because I remember mm-hmm. when Harambe got started before it became a charter school.
Mm-hmm.
The question has to be, really, is it really what John Skeef, meaning the founder, is
yes.
that really what he envisioned? Okay.
Yeah,
but,
I don't know.
Right.
But now, where did you see this issue in the Philadelphia Tribune in terms of the black schools being...
I saw it in one of the white newspapers, like the Daily News or the Inquirer, one of them.
Oh.
I'll send it to you. Oh, yeah.
Okay.
They literally are asking for an investigation, I believe.
Oh, good.
Yeah. Because there's an association. It's called the African American Charter School Association.
Oh.
They have literally an association. Of all of the black charter schools in Philadelphia. And they're all saying now that that the public school system, the Philadelphia, whatever they're called, board or whatever, is discriminating against the black charter schools. I'll send you the article because we're going to have this conversation on Saturday when we talk to Q Butter, because you know my position has been for 2 decades, we need our own. And I'm not saying we shouldn't have charter schools, but we should have our own. Also.
Independent schools. But yes,
absolutely.
We need, and funding.
Absolutely.
Funding is always
absolutely.
The issue.
Well,
now, there's
this
another.
Is why well, this is
there's
why with the We Charge
school.
Inside 21, that mm-hmm. that is what that can do. Because
mm-hmm.
we're now talking
mm-hmm.
about as a part of reparatory justice. That's a totally
right.
different ballgame. Totally
yes.
different ballgame. You see,
yes,
so,
yes,
so,
yes.
so that's what we've been, you know, we've been waiting, just waiting, you know, to bring that position forward because, you know it has to be funded, but rather than to keep trying to compete or, you know, keep going through the same processes.
Right, right. Yeah, and operating at, what, 80% of what the normal school district gets, that's what I heard. So they're operating on a lesser budget, you know, in comparison to the regular school district. So they're operating at 80% of what it would normally cost a regular school to operate, you know, public school to operate. So they're working on a budget that's 80% of what everyone else gets. And they're still coming on top. I mean, you know, Veronica's school, excellent. And she, unfortunately, she can't find anyone to take her place. I don't know if there's anyone that could take her place. There's another charter school, and I'm trying to think of it now. I can't. Naomi Booker. She has a charter school. I don't know exactly what the name of it. Dr. Naomi Booker. I don't know what the name of it is. But I would love to see that article because those are important. Is Lotus Academy still operating? Uh-oh. Hello? Wait a minute. Did I lose you?
Okay. Somehow we just got cut off.
What?
I don't know. Well, you know, it's technology. It does what it does. But lastly,
right,
what I
right.
was saying is that we're going to have this conversation on Saturday to kind of do a comparative analysis and to look at, you know, one of our positions for the We Charge Genocide 21 is that we have to have our own educations. And because we've been working on it for a while, we even have our own system that we're developing. Because what we realize is you can't dismantle something or remove yourself from something and not have something to replace it with. So it can't just be we have a building. We have to literally have a structure with curriculum. And this is some of the things we've been working on. So now, and you've heard us talk on numerous occasions, Sister Sheila, about, for example, Dr. Ed Robinson's curriculum.
Oh, goodness, yes. Some
yeah.
high princess,
so, yes. Yes, some things are already there. It's just there.
Right. It's already in place. Yeah. You're absolutely
right.
Right. And even the dessert club was using his curriculum at one point.
Absolutely.
And I'm not sure now that the brother is gone. You know, I'm not certain how that's going to continue to play out. But, yeah, we have a lot of work to do. We have massive amounts of work to do. But as long as we have people like you, as long as we have people like you, we'll be okay, especially sharing the information. Yes,
I should.
Thank you. That'll be
thank you.
Saturday at 9, correct?
No, our regular radio program every Saturday night is 10:30.
Oh, 10:30, that's right. Okay,
our regular, every week, the one that we've been going for almost 15 years. Every Saturday night is 10:30 Eastern time.
Yeah, it just slipped my mind.
Right, but I'll be sending out a blast. Yeah, I'll be sending out a blast. All right, my sister, good day.
All right,
family, we're going to play just a few more minutes of this Ella Baker interview. And, again, we will revisit this before we close out this week to bring you more about her and our installment initiative for our sister saints, because next year is the 175th year of the great Araminta. Of course, most know her as Harriet Tubman, but her given name was Araminta. And we've researched and know that according to what we've found, her lineage, meaning her parents, were brought in from, brought in is too nice. They were kidnapped from Ghana. So when we begin this installment process for Araminta / Harriet Tubman, it will be here in the U.S., but we also look to do something in Ghana. So we're literally getting ready to talk with one of the Ghanaian representatives in order to next year. We're saying it's wonderful to have a statue for her, which a lot of cities are now doing. We want the Harriet Tubman Justice and Humanity Center.
I went there.
Oh, hold on 1 minute. I was trying to. I'm going to cue that back up for you. We're going to go back to the interview, and it popped up by itself. But the point is, we want something that people can come to on a day-to-day basis and get services. And since St. Harriet Tubman was about freedom and justice, then we need to be providing those kinds of things on a day-to-day basis. So, again, our mission and focus with Harriet Tubman in recognition of her work is to create an inclusion that exemplifies what she did and that we are her children. Okay. All right, family, listen, before we close out, let's go back to a little bit more of the interview with Saint Ella Baker. And again, we'll talk more about her in the very near future, because towards the end of this week, we'll literally have some of the people with us who were in SNCC. Aha! So, check this out.
Program, which was to have 20-odd meetings in different cities simultaneously on the same night, February 12th. So I had anticipated being there about 6 weeks. Give myself 4 weeks to get things going and 2 weeks to clean it up. But they had no problem. And how did they get Reverend Tilley? They wanted a minister. I knew that. They couldn't have tolerated a woman, and they couldn't have tolerated a woman.
Well, let me reintroduce you something. I had a team to look at the criteria for selection that was suggested by Dr. Keith and a couple of people to the selection committee.
When was the criteria suggested?
Well, in 58. That he shouldn't just confine that consideration to ministers. You know, and I thought it was kind of strange that he made that point, but I think that it was made advisedly in that he wanted to encourage bringing in speak with a few more administrative skills that he believed ministers had, you know. But anyway, he wound up in Dr. Tilly. But as soon as Dr. Tilly resigned, you stepped in and became executive director. And from the sources I've seen, I also see where you conceived this idea of the citizenship crusade. And you spare a lot of detail, some of the things you felt should be done. Did you encounter any difficulties in trying to get this problem over, or was SCLC glad to get it, this proposal?
Well, first place, Reverend Tilly became executive, largely because I knew Tilly. They had, I knew they wanted a minister. They advised us to schedule to go down even at the time I went instead of me. I never anticipated. To set up the office. And after setting up the office, and after the program of February the 12th had taken place, there became pressure from the people, the ministers who were involved, for an organization. Person who you might talk to if you ever get around to it is a minister in Nashville, Smith, James Smith,
Kellen Smith,
yes. Very perceptive young man at the time. And so when they wanted, they hadn't found anybody, or at least they hadn't decided on, they thought in terms of Dr., the young man who's now dead, I think, became president of Birmingham College. Pitt was a teacher in Georgia, and I had known him in my NAACP days. So I went to him and talked with him, and he asked me to talk with him. They had made some slight overtures to him, and then he decided he couldn't do that. So I suggested they had waited, gone around. Nothing was happening. Someday they'd see. What was happening was nothing except what I was doing in the office there. And so I suggested that they had to have a minister. There was, and I heard that Tilly had been responsible for a voter registration drive in Baltimore, which may or may not be quite accurate, because that was no doubt masterminded by the president of the Baltimore branch NHCP, Mrs. Jackson, and her daughter, Juanita, who is the wife of Clarence Mitchell, who is the NHCP Washington director. So anyhow, they never got around to calling anybody. So Stanley and I met Tilly here in New York. Tilly said he would be interested. And then he went down to see them. And he became the executive director, and but he maintained his church connections in Baltimore, which meant he was in and out. And so whatever was being done in terms of continuity, that was done by whoever was there.
So, family, listen, we're going to close this session out. Just wanted to kind of give you a general idea of this. This is the woman, the black woman, you could tell that she was truly an organizer. And this is what we're raising up now again today, meaning we need folks, women and men, who are serious. Our ancestors were serious. I mean, they were no joke. This wasn't just something that they did, you know, as a, you know, this stuff that you're seeing today. Mm-mm. These folks did this every day. Now, we know that, you know, many can't do that today, but certainly we can do more than what we have been doing. Because if we don't, this is only going to get worse. So anyway, in the spirit of the great Ella Baker, Ella Josephine Baker, and that's a whole nother name we got to talk about, Josephine Baker, but We're going to talk more about her again before we close out this session during this time period of what we call the Here We Stand Conference. And again, family, you know, you're going to hear of a lot of what we're now bringing forward. There's going to be a special announcement on December 31st. We will be doing our Kwanzaa program here in Philly, but it will be brought nationwide via Zoom. And we want you all to be involved because what you're getting ready to hear, we're taking it to other cities. We're going to give a report on December 31st. That's the day of Kaumba, creativity, and we will be giving a report on how we have already sent a poll or slash survey to black elected officials on the city council level so far. And it has five questions. And one of the questions is we wanted to know their position on reparations, yes or no. And we'll tell you about the other four questions as we proceed. But again, one of them also had to do with their position on working to fight to make certain that our students or those who have been students who are now in debt as a result of student loan debt, we want it rescinded. That's a part of reparations that can happen now, not down the road somewhere. We don't need to hold our discussion about that. Our people are in debt as a result of wanting higher education. Many are in debt thousands of dollars. We have parents who have second mortgage their homes. And we're saying with a presidential election coming, we need to have a platform ready so that if they're going to be coming into our community wanting people to vote for them, they need to be talking about what they're going to do for us. So we'll be telling you more about that as we proceed. But that is one of the other things on the survey that we've issued already to black city council members. And we also will be doing it for senators, state reps, and so forth, because we want it on paper what their position is on certain things. Then that way, when they come into our community asking people to vote, we'll be able to say, well, wait a minute. Did you say you was for this? So let's see what you did in regards to that. Again, we're raising the bar. Family, we thank you all again and definitely appreciate so much, you know, all what you all are doing, have been doing, and guess what? How about we'll be doing in the future? And again, in the spirit of the great Ella Baker, we are, you know, so thankful that the Creator gave to us someone of her caliber, someone of her greatness, and we will be always, always eternally grateful and thankful for her and others. So we'll talk to you tomorrow night. And again, we're going to play her one more time, her one of her famous speeches, only 2 minutes. But check this out, family. This, again, is the great Ella Baker.
Friends, brothers, and sisters in the struggle for human dignity and freedom, I am here to represent the struggle that has gone on for 300 or more years. A struggle to be recognized as citizens in a country in which we were born. I have had about 40 or 50 years of struggle, ever since a little boy on the streets of Norfolk called me a nigger. I struck him back.
Yeah, she struck him back. She said ever since, you know, called her the N-word. You heard her. We tried to bleep it a little.
All right, family. That again was the great Ella Baker. Talk to you next time. Have a blessed one. Peace to you all.